Thank you, Robert, for reading that for us. Robert Ulry is one of our young men in the academy, a senior, I believe, aren't you, Robert? Junior. He's in a Tuesday class that the junior and senior boys have on Tuesdays there. Thankful for him. He's one of a fine group of young men. Last Sunday evening, I'm not sure whether at this hour or the earlier hour, but I mentioned it just a few moments ago at the first session. But last week, I made the statement that the Feast of Dedication had its origins in the Babylonian exile period during the time of Esther. But I got to thinking about it and later on realized that I had said the wrong thing. That's not true. The feast that originated during the time of Esther was the Feast of Purim, P-U-R-I-M, and it did originate during the Babylonian exile period, when the Jews were finally freed of their oppressors, and they still observe that feast today, but it's the Feast of Purim. The Feast of the Dedication had its origin during the intertestamental period, during the days of Judas Maccabeus, when Judas Maccabeus cleansed the temple from its Roman defilement after it had had some pigs offered on it. He went in and drove out the Syrians, and dedicated the temple again, and they have kept that feast and were keeping it at the time of Christ, and so that's what was referred to in John the 7th chapter. But it had its origin during the intertestamentary period, and I wanted to clarify that tonight before I forgot it. This incident that we have just read about, coming as it does in the midst of all the intrigue and the questioning and bickering and arguing among the enemies of Jesus, and their open attempts to arrest him, and their open attempts to stone him, plus all the other hassle that we see going on in these chapters from chapter 5 on through to the end of the book. This event here, coming as it does in the midst of all of that, is like a cup of cool water in a desert. Not because the incident shows any letting up of the efforts of the Jews to entrap Jesus at all. That's not the thing. In fact, this incident itself, the writer John says that they perpetrated this thing, or they presented it, and they asked him this question about the law because they were trying to entrap him. They weren't really interested in the law. They weren't really interested in this woman. They were interested in getting Jesus trapped so they would have some basis for bringing judgment against him. But the thing that's so refreshing about it is that here, for the first time in John's Gospel, we find a third party being introduced into the plot. Now, their attacks against Jesus had always involved just Jesus. They attacked him on other occasions, even more vehemently than they did on this occasion. But you see, here, there's another factor involved. Here was a human being thrown into it, and the life and well-being of this woman is thrown into this event. And as a result, Jesus' own life was being weighed now against her life. And the thing that's so beautifully refreshing is to see how Jesus responds to it. And even when his own life and well-being is at stake, we see him place his life alongside of the one that was condemned. Really, this is the most direct confrontation that the Jews ever made against Jesus involving the well-being of another person. Now, Lazarus, they wanted to kill Lazarus too, but Lazarus wasn't guilty of anything. This woman here, we're going to find her human predicament, and it's the only time, I believe, where another human being's plight was thrown in with the Lord's in contradistinction to his, but thrown in for the purpose of hanging him. And so we find this very unusual twist in this particular incident in his life. And the thing that's so challenging about it is this. You know, Jesus spoke well. He did real well in talking about things in parables. Now, he told the parable of the prodigal son, one of the most touching stories in all human language, about the young man that went off and betrayed his father and disgraced his father. You know the story. And how that he went away and then came back after he had met with ill fortune, his money gone, and came back asking for a job, but totally reduced to just misery. And he came back, and Jesus tells that in such a way as it just literally tugs on the heartstrings. And he shows the love of the Father. As the Father saw him coming, and he ran out to meet him and threw himself upon this young man's neck and kissed him much. And you see, you know, that's a beautiful picture of the way that God responds to a sinner. Jesus was good at telling things like that about his Father. He told another story in Matthew 18 about a man who owed $10 million to his king. And Jesus told how that the man begged, and he paints the picture very vividly. The man begging, "Please, don't sell me. Don't sell my wife and children. If you'll just be merciful, I'll pay you the whole thing." And Jesus says that his Lord was moved with compassion, and he forgave him the whole $10 million debt. Jesus does real well in telling those stories. Now, the thing that's interesting about this event is that it's taken out of the realm of parable. It's taken out of the realm of theory and stories. This is an actual event in his life. And the thing that I want you to see tonight is his response when it comes down to being an actual event. I want us to see if it harmonizes with what he said in those parables and in those stories. On this occasion, we see life at its rawest state. We see it at its ugliest state and at its most sublime state. We find it at its most realistic state, because in it we see what we find and we find representing life all the way through in all of literature. Most every intrigue that we read about always contains three principal characters: the villains, a damsel in distress, and a hero. Now, I don't care whether it's a horse opera or a soap opera. It just really doesn't matter. We seem to never tire away from reality. No, it implies what it is. This is the whole of life. This is the way life's lived. And we find ourselves constantly telling that story over and over and over in one form or another, because this is meeting us where we are. And so that's the format. And that's the plot of this incident here. Within this incident, we see the operating force of the life of the Lord. I call it the dynamic. Now, that threw Brother Davis off. He looked up in the dictionary the dynamic and arranged his songs around it. But the dynamic doesn't mean, in one respect, the force and power, but it does mean the force operating within a field. The dynamic of something as a noun means that power operating and manifesting itself as the power within that person's life that explains why he is what he is. And that's what we see. When you see how Jesus deals with this woman, you know what you're seeing? You're seeing Jesus. You're getting a glimpse into his life. And so I want us to look at it tonight in just two simple ways. First of all, I want you to see the human predicament. Now, by predicament, I mean the trap that we find ourselves being caught in. And we're all caught in it at one time or another, to one degree or other. We're caught in this trap. The story, part of it, only two verses really deal with it. Beginning in three verses, verses 3-5. The story, or the account, begins with Jesus going into the temple early one morning during this, or shortly after the Feast of the Dedication. It was his custom to go in there and teach. And it says that all the people gathered round about him, and he began to teach them. And all of a sudden, there was this rustling and bustling and people elbowing their way through. And those who were aware of it perhaps looked. In fact, they would have looked to see what was happening. And here they would have seen a woman being brought in by a group of men who were obviously religious men. They would have had on their long robes, their phylacteries would have been broad, their borders would have been broad. They would have had this long sideburn. If you'll see them today, it's the same custom. They have this custom of curling their sideburns, and their sideburns will hang way down. And this indicates that these men are Orthodox Jews. And they would have had that, and they would have had this little box on their head that contained some of the scriptures, and they'd look like, who knows what. But that was their custom. That's the way they did, to let everybody know that they were religious people. Well, here they would have come bringing this woman into the midst. They wouldn't have been walking holding her hand. Heavens, no. They wouldn't have thought about doing that. I suspect if they had any touching of her at all, it would have been around her arm. They would have had her hold of her to keep her from running away, perhaps. And perhaps one on each side of her. And they would have then brought her, and as your translation read tonight, they made her stand before the whole group. It says they placed her in the midst. And there she stood, embarrassed. This is the human predicament. This is where it begins. And I want you to see then two or three things about the human predicament. One, this woman, like you and I, the victim of her passions, victim of her weaknesses. For we all once were foolish, disobedient, led astray, slaves to various passions and pleasures, passing our days in malice and envy, hated by men and hating one another. This is just a common description of our human predicament. This isn't anything unusual. It's nothing that's unfamiliar to us. We're aware of it. I'll tell you something else that is the human predicament. We all crave love and self-respect, self-worth. And yet, that's not really a predicament. That's just our nature. The predicament lies in the fact that often we settle for a substitute. How often you sell yourself short, how often I've sold myself short as I search for and long for and crave the fulfilling of this need of love, the need to be feeling of self-worth. How many times have you sold yourself short? How many times have you girls sold yourself short? Craving love, craving affection. Many times you sell yourself short by accepting something that really many times not only is a substitute, but it's a synthetic. This woman was accepting a synthetic. You know, I made this statement at the earlier hour, and a man who is a psychiatrist advised that he probably didn't agree with it. And I'm going to tell you what I said and then tell you what he said, and then we're going to look at it just briefly in passing. I said that a woman has a need for emotional support more than just an expression of physical love. And he said it's true that she needs that, but he said men need that too. I made mention of the fact that men are more beastly, they're more earthy, and they can be perhaps satisfied with physical love where a woman needs emotional support and security. He said, well, it's true that women need that, but he said, I believe men need it too. And to settle for less than that is to sell yourself short. So let's just say tonight we're all in this human predicament, longing to be loved, wanting to be accepted, wanting to be esteemed worthy and honorable, and yet so many times accepting less than that and selling ourselves short. And so we find ourselves, like this woman, betrayed by sin. You see, she really wasn't fulfilled. What she really was wanting, she had to come to the one that they brought her to in order to receive it. The man that she was committing adultery with, that didn't fulfill her or bring her what she was wanting mostly. And so she found herself being ripped off by people who were her acquaintances, ripped off by people who really were religious people. And so she found herself being ripped off by people, betrayed by sin, and she found herself in this terrifying position of being alone. And there she stood in the midst. You know, she must have been terrified or angered or totally embarrassed. But there she stood. And a fourth thing, you find that the predicament that we find, the human predicament, is that of guilty before the law. Jesus didn't claim that she was innocent at all. She had no way to plead innocence. She was caught in the midst of this activity of adultery. And they knew it. They had caught her. I suspect that it was a put-up job. I suspect that they had trapped her in order to have her as an object of this design that they were trying to work in order to entrap Jesus. But I want to ask you a question. How would you feel tonight if your favorite sin were exposed before this whole group here tonight? What if you were to be hauled down this aisle and made to stand there while the finger of accusation was pointed at you, and your favorite secret sin, the one that only you and your secret heart knows about, if it were exposed and broadcast to this whole group, how would you feel? And you have one of those favorite sins. You have one of those peculiar weaknesses that belongs to you. Well, that's the human predicament she found herself in it. I think you can identify with her. This is the human predicament. But that's not what's unique about this incident. We're aware of the human predicament enough. We know it is familiar to us. But what's unique is the next and second thing, the last. It's the divine prerogative. That's what's beautiful about this. The divine prerogative here is new in a sense that it had been taken away. The people weren't aware of it. It was now reintroduced. The people could get a good full sight of it. And so we find that the divine prerogative, and I mean by the divine prerogative, to put it down in simple terms, we don't use the expression here, but I'm going to use it tonight just to describe this. What is your pleasure? That's a strange way of asking, what do you really like? The divine prerogative is the right to choose one option over another. The right, simply by the very nature of your power, of Jesus' power. He had a prerogative. He could do this or he could do this. And so you ask him, Lord, what is your want? What is your pleasure? And when you see Jesus respond to this woman, you see the pleasure of the Lord. If you were to leave Jesus to do what he wanted to do, then you see him doing this. It's here that in Jesus' response that we see the dynamic of his life. And that's what I meant by when you see his response here, you see his dynamic. In other words, this is the way he operates. This is the power that controls his life. And when you see him operating here, this is what you're seeing. But boy, what a time and what a beautiful opportunity for him had he been wanting to make points with those people who were the up and in people in religion. What a beautiful time and opportunity this was to say, I believe in the law. I believe it ought to be upheld. And I just think that this woman, you're right, she ought to be killed. Let's get busy at it. There was only one problem. There was a person involved. There was a human being involved. And so this becomes Jesus' most severe test. It becomes his most telling test as he works through this dilemma. You see, he was introduced into a real dilemma. If he upheld the law, she would have to be punished. If he upheld her, then he would be breaking the law. So how would he then be introduced into this thing and come out smelling like a rose? And at the same time, save her life. And so you see him identifying with her. How is he going to solve it or settle it? Well, there are five things I want to mention just briefly. I want to make about two comments about each. But I want you to remember this progression that Jesus, we see in him here as he deals with this woman. Watch him now as he works. And it's in this that you get a glimpse of the Lord and the way that he cared for people. Number one, watch him as he takes the attention off the woman and places it on himself. And that's found in verse 6, in the latter part of it, where whenever they brought him and said, now the law says, stoner, what do you say? This fella stooped down and began to write on the ground. And I just wonder if they thought, well, what is he doing? And where all the attention had been focused on the woman, now all the eyes of the people round about were watching this man as he stooped down and began to write in the ground. And the people who had brought the woman began to sense perhaps something, and it was a false scent, but they began to think, oh, we've got him. He doesn't know the answer. And they kept pressing him. Oh, what do you say? The law says kill her. What do you say? And I can just see the exuberation as it swept over these men, as they finally, after months and months of getting the daylights beat out of them by this man, with just simply a simple word, he'd just whip them and send them running. They finally sensed that they were winning, and they had finally trapped him. Well, that's all right. The woman also, her attention, I suspect, was taken off herself. She was very self-conscious. You know she must have been when she was brought in there, and she must have been weighed down with the sense of guilt and shame. And I don't doubt but what her attention was taken off herself. She lost this sense of self-consciousness because she couldn't figure out what he was doing either. So her sense of self-consciousness was taken away from her, and she lost her own shame, or she lost this feeling of being the center of attraction, and the spotlight was taken off of her and placed on this man as he stooped there to write in the sand. So the first thing that he did, he decided to take the attention off of the woman and put it on himself. Now that's beautiful. That's absolutely beautiful. But look, a second thing. He looked for a way to show mercy to the woman. Now, I don't know how long it took him. He may have known instantly. I don't know. But I like to think of it in terms of his saying, now how can I go about showing mercy to this woman? I've got to figure out a way to show mercy to her. And so what he did was he turned the tables on them. He, in a sense, said, all right, you've caught her red-handed. Fair enough. If you've got two or three witnesses, all right, then stone her. And yet he placed the standard of the stoner as being so high, he said, whichever one of you is without sin, let him be the first one to start throwing stones at her. And then he just stooped down and began to write again in the sand. And I can imagine that they would say, all right, go ahead and I'll throw the second one. And he'd say, no, you throw the first one and I'll throw the second one. It's noted here that the older ones began to leave first. They just began to wander away. It was such a crisis that they were called upon to examine themselves and do some introspection. It's interesting here that the older ones were the ones who were aware of it first. And I'm not quite sure. Sometimes our young people here are the very ones to first respond to their own needs. The older people, perhaps, are the ones who perhaps don't express it so much, but maybe they're the first ones to sense their needs. I don't know. I can't sort that out. But anyway, he looked for a way to show this woman mercy. So he just simply turned the tables on these people and said, all right, let's stone her. The first one of you that's without sin, you go ahead and throw the first stone. But then a third thing. In verse 10, we find him restoring her sense of self-worth, her sense of dignity. Now, how did he do it? In a very beautiful, simple, genuine way. Jesus restored this woman's sense of dignity by talking to her, by speaking with her. He could have said to his disciples, get the woman, get her out of my sight. Tell her to get out and don't ever let me see her again, you know, or tell her to go. They've left her, you, John, Simon, or somebody, tell her to get out of here and be thankful that she didn't get killed. Well, we've done that. You know, you say a lot to a person about whether or not you're willing to talk with them, by whether or not you're willing to converse with them. You say a whole lot to them as to whether they're worthy of being in your presence or not. Did you ever do that? Did you ever give somebody a message through somebody else because you were too good to actually speak to that one person? Why, sure. Did you ever talk down your nose to someone and let them know just simply by the way that you talked to them that you really didn't regard them as of any value? Oh, how we do that. We use our body language to do that many times. We let them know real quick. You know, you can look them up and down. Oh, there are many ways that you can show people you're not really worth all that much. But Jesus began to restore this woman's dignity by conversing with her. He said, woman, where are your accusers? Did no man condemn you? She said, no man, Lord. Now watch, he called her woman. And you might think, well, that's not all that complimentary a title. And yet it was. It was a title of respect. Listen, this is the same, the word gunais, it's the same word, gunai, that he used when he talked to his mother in John 2. When she said to him, his mother said in John 2, they have no more wine. He said to her, woman, what is that to you and me? And one man translated it as being, dear lady, what is that to you and me? It was a title of respect. It was a title of not berating her at all. And so he uses that same title that he used on his mother or to his mother here when he asked this woman, woman, where are your accusers? And though to say, you are guilty, but good lady, where are those that accused you? And she said, there are none, Lord. So he restored her sense of dignity and self-worth by just simply conversing with her. Then fourthly, he sent her away forgiven. He said, I don't condemn you either. Sent her away forgiven. not making her promise, don't you ever do that again. Do you promise that you're not ever going to act like that again? That's not what he said. He just simply said, I don't condemn you. Beautiful. He sent her away forgiven. And then finally, he called her to a higher plane of living. He said, instead of course he didn't condone what she did, but he let her know that in terms that would convey to her that he loved her and that he had respect for her as an individual, as a human being, and that he reckoned her as one of his associates by conversing with her, and he sent her away forgiven and in the process called her to a new plane of living. He said, go and don't you sin anymore now. And he just left her to go and be free. So watch the process now as this woman was caught in her human predicament, where all of us can identify. And he caught her, and she was brought to him, and watch him now as he began to restore her. He relieved her embarrassment by taking the attention off of her and putting it on himself. He then looked for a way to show mercy to her. He then restored her sense of dignity and self-worth. He then sent her away forgiven, and then called her to a higher plane of living. Man, that is so down to earth and so right to our needs that I find, you know what? This was a stroke of genius. Here he was, you see, his life was on the line too. His life and her life were in the balance. See if he'd sacrifice her to save himself. I wonder if he would. No, not this man. He found a way to be merciful to her and bring the real condemnation on those who were accusing her. This is the dynamic of the gospel. As I read this, John, the 8th chapter, these 11 verses, I think of the prospective view of the gospel and the prospective view of the Messiah in Isaiah 53. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that made us whole, and with his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We've turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. I find that here in John lived out. Isaiah mentioned it in prospect. Here in John 8, we find him living that out. Later on, in retrospect, the Apostle Paul wrote to Titus and said, we all once were foolish, disobedient, led astray, slaves to various passions and pleasures, passing our days in malice and envy, hated by men and hating one another. But when the goodness and loving kindness of God our Savior appeared, he saved us. Not because of deeds done by us in righteousness, but in virtue of his own mercy. I find Isaiah 53 and Titus 3 coming together in John 8. That's what it was talking about. And so I find that in prospect, Jesus was to act in a certain way. In retrospect, they said he did act. And sure enough, in the reality of the present, you find him there in John 8, conducting himself in such a way that he took upon himself the embarrassment of the woman, took upon himself the cost of her sin, and even in that very simple incident, he foretold the coming of what he was going to do on the cross. And very gently and yet very forcibly, he said on that occasion what he said on the cross that has reverberated all the way down through history, when he said, Father, forgive them. That's the divine request that you find coming out in this John the 8th chapter. I find this to be self-corroborating evidence. How can this evidence feed your faith tonight? Well, like this. You find him saying that this is the way God is, talking about it, you know, and telling parables and telling stories and saying about the way God is. But then when you see his line, or his life laid on the line, and when you see his neck in the noose, when you see his life being placed in the balance with somebody else's to see whether or not he'll sacrifice her to save his own neck, not a chance. This man was what he claimed to be. And so we find him standing in for God, and this is the God that he has come to tell us about. The God that would relieve our embarrassment and take the spotlight off of us. The God that would look for a way to show us mercy. The God that would then turn the tables on our accusers. The God that would do all of this for us, forgive us, and then send us away to a higher plane of living. This is what we find in this John, the 8th chapter, the first 11 verses. If you've seen tonight in him somebody that you really and truly love, this is beautiful to me. This is what tugs at my heart and says to me, you know, I want to serve a God like that. If we're going to serve a God, let me serve one like this. I want Jesus as my God. And I think you'll do the same. If you'd like to serve him, if you'd like to give yourself to him, do. Don't you wait. Give yourself to him now. Whatever may be your pleasure, what would you like to do? What do you think God wants you to do? Won't you come and give yourself to him tonight? Let us stand and encourage each other.